Could be a perfect storm for homeowners as new rules for property insurance about to hit just as Hurricane Harvey takes aim at the Texas coast. Welcome to the Texas Take, a weekly insider's look at the world of politics in the great state. Thank you so much for making us the number one political podcast in Texas. I'm Scott Braddock, the editor at QuorumReport.com.
And I'm Mike Ward, Austin Bureau Chief for the Houston Chronicle and HoustonChronicle.com.
Mike, we're going to start with a question of politics and policy because we do have a hurricane pointed right at the state of Texas, at South Texas right now, looking at the latest track for Hurricane Harvey, which could be a Category 4 storm by the time it hits. And the time frame for this is basically this weekend, Friday, and then through the weekend, through early next week.
Right.
You can see major rain out of this. You could have more than 12 inches in places. We were talking before the show started that it wasn't just the fact that it's a hurricane, it's the fact that it's a tropical system. Anytime you're talking about a tropical system, you got to take it seriously. Tropical Storm Allison, not a hurricane, more than a decade ago, devastating in Houston, $9 billion in damage from that. There's about 55 deaths from that. When you look at the hurricane that hit in 2005 in Louisiana, Hurricane Katrina, this storm is going to be about as strong as that one was when it hit New Orleans. This is going to be either a Cat 3 or a Cat 4. And so the people all along the coast have to be very concerned right now and doing a lot of various prep work.
That's right. Hurricanes are always serious business. Having both of us have been reporters for quite some time, and we both covered hurricanes. We've both been in hurricanes.
Yeah.
And it's not any place to fun around.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, to the public policy of this, there is a brand new law taking effect that has to do with property insurance. This was first sold as a hailstorm piece of legislation during the legislative session that wrapped up earlier this year. But we're actually talking about any kind of damage from really any storm. The critics of this called it the blue tarp bill because,
right,
you know, you might file a claim on your home after it was damaged by a hurricane or some other sort of storm and then have to put the blue tarp on the rule while you or on the roof while you wait for the insurance company to pay the claim. And there is some question about whether this just goes too far, whether homeowners are going to be hung out to dry on this deal. I was looking at News Channel 12 in Beaumont. They, of course, have a vested interest in this. They did a fact check of some of the claims about this bill, which was promoted by Texans for Lawsuit Reform and Republicans in the legislature. It does take effect September 1st, right after the storm will have blown through.
Right.
So all the rules will be different. This will be the first test for how all this works. And at News Channel 12, what they did was they looked at six claims. And the first claim was that this bill discourages lawsuits against insurance companies. They found that's true. The bill's author, Greg Bonin of Friendswood, said the bill is supposed to curb lawsuit abuse after a 1,400% spike in storm damage-related lawsuits in Texas from 2012 to 2015. They looked at another claim. The second claim was that HB 1774 protects property owners. That's undecided as far as their fact check. This assertion can be deemed true or false depending on the personal interpretation of the bill. The biggest factor, they said, behind this claim is that by holding insurance companies and lawyers in check, the property owner wins. That's according to the author of the bill. If you think these guidelines live up to that claim, then that's true. But if you think that a property owner won't even try to sue because the guidelines make it harder to sue, then it's false. So it's depending. It is dependent on who you ask, basically, on that one. Third claim, the bill limits liability for insurance companies. That's just flat true. Lawsuits can be filed over deceptive trade practices or unfair settlements, or but not both. That's spelled out in one of the sections of the bill. The fourth claim was that it cuts penalties for insurance companies. That they found to absolutely be true. The interest penalty has gone down by 3%. The sixth claim is that the bill encourages abuse and delay by insurance insurers, and they found that that is undecided. Now, Mike, you've covered tort reform in Texas for years. It's always a controversial deal where you have certain folks in the business community trying to limit basically run into the courthouse over this and that. Then on the other side, you've got the trial lawyers and consumer advocates saying, no, people need to be able to sue if their insurance company is not paying quickly on these claims because people are, you know, living with the blue tarp on the roof.
That's right. You know, insurance and tort reform are two things that always come to the legislature for some kind of resolution or tweak. And frankly, having this storm move in right before these new laws take effect, this new law takes effect, is going to be a true test, because major storm damage always is extremely aggravating to quite a number of policyholders, and can trigger a lot of lawsuits, and it obviously triggers a lot of claims for the insurance companies.
Yeah, something else that was pointed out to me today is that, you know, the insurance commissioner passed away earlier this year, and the governor has yet to name anybody to be the head of TDI. And so we'll see, again, if the bureaucracy can withstand the onslaught of the storm. And a lot of it, of course, is dependent on just how bad this storm is. As we talked about before the show, with Hurricane Rita, you had how many people evacuated Houston? Almost 3 million in about 24, 48 hours. And then the storm didn't hit Houston.
Massive evacuation.
Yeah, massive evacuation. I was walking alongside the freeways as a reporter at KTRH there in Houston, talking to people as they were trying to get out of the way of the storm. And it had been pointed at Houston, but then right at the last minute, all those people were out, and I was still there on the ground, and it was just light rain in town. There's just no way to know what's going to happen with one of these storms.
That's right. Hurricanes are prone or known to change path at the last minute before they make landfall.
Yeah, and there's always criticism of the media. Believe me, I've been there and read the emails and taken the phone calls about it. You know, on the one hand, people will say you're hyping it up too much. If it doesn't turn out to be anything, or if it does, you know, if it turns out to be less than maybe what they thought it was going to be. On the other hand, if you didn't cover it, then you would take the heat for that, because the storm would hit and it would be horrible. There's really no way to win.
But with any hurricane, there's going to be a lot of property damage. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's extensive. Sometimes it's confined to a certain area. The size of this storm and the forecasts at this point indicate that this is going to have a major effect on the Texas coast. Mm-hmm. And so we'll be following how this new insurance law does, how it fares. After Harvey moves ashore.
Yeah, absolutely. And for real-time coverage, of course, of the storm, go to HoustonChronicle.com. They'll have complete coverage there right on the homepage all throughout the entire time that this unfolds over the weekend. Now, back to just straight politics here. Big decisions from the courts on both voter ID and on redistricting. We'll start with the redistricting decision that came down over the last week, and we get the latest on that from Texas Public Radio's Capitol reporter, Ryan Poppy.
The three-judge federal panel in San Antonio presiding over the case challenging the state's 2013 congressional voting maps ruled that they were drawn to intentionally discriminate against minority voters and that the state violated the U.S. Voting Rights Act. The court then ordered Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton to provide an answer on how the state plans to proceed, by either requesting the governor call another special session or have the courts redesign the congressional districts belonging to Republican Blake Farenthold and Democrat Lloyd Doggett. Mark Rylander with the Attorney General's office says Paxton filed an appeal with the U.S. Supreme Court on Friday, asking that they overturn the San Antonio court's decision.
The motion also advises that Governor Abbott respectfully declines the court's invitation at this time to ask the legislature to take up redistricting.
Jose Garza is an attorney with the Mexican American Legislative Caucus, one of the groups representing plaintiffs who sued the state. The court has yet to release its opinion over the 2013 state House district maps, which are also being reviewed for intentional racial gerrymandering.
There is no finality yet, but the way the law is structured, the state can do piecemeal appeals. But there's no injunction, there's no remedy that has been ordered for that violation yet.
Both sides will get a chance to present their redistricting plans on how they'd like the maps to appear before the three-judge panel in San Antonio on September 5th. Ryan Poppy, Texas Public Radio News.
And to check out all of Texas Public Radio's coverage, go to tpr.org. The other big decision: a federal judge told lawmakers that they did not do the necessary due diligence to fix the voter ID law in this state and struck it down, Mike. Said you'd need to come back and come up with something else.
These two cases have been going on for quite some time, both redistricting. It's been going on so long that it may still be going on when we do our next redistricting.
Yes, it will.
And voter ID has been a very contentious issue from the very start.
So what is it that the judge was looking at here? There was a law that was passed, in 2011? Then there was a fix this session that was supposed to kind of loosen it up a little bit because there had been a previous ruling on it?
Based on an appellate court ruling, and the plaintiffs had gone back to court and said, that's not correct, and The court said that's not correct, so now the state's going to appeal this.
Yeah, it was a 27-page ruling from Judge Nelva Gonzalez-Ramos. She said to lawmakers that they didn't do the proper due diligence to fix the inherent problems with the voter ID bill that was set out by the court. Ramos wrote that the state's legislative solution did expand the types of ID that can be used for voters, but it did not prove that such identification met the standards necessary to cure the problems associated with SB 14. And of course, when we saw these debates play out, you know, you had Democrats offering amendments to try to add to the different types of IDs that could be used, for example, but Republicans were not having that. And then when this latest fix was put in place, a quote-unquote fix was put in place, there was also a move to prosecute people if they say that they don't have an ID and they would sign some sort of an affidavit that would say, you know, here's the reason I don't have an ID. But if they were lying, then they could potentially be taken to task for that.
Right. And the backdrop on this is a number of voter fraud investigations that are underway across Texas. Uh-huh. High contentiousness on both sides, Republican and Democrat, in the arguments about voter ID. This issue is also being litigated in other states as well.
Yeah.
So Texas is not alone, but it's particularly contentious in Texas because of the fear, the assertions by the plaintiffs that this is an attempt by the Republicans to suppress minority votes.
Well, the judge also said that, you know, despite the fact that there have been some prosecutions of, you know, some voter fraud in certain places, she did say that there has been no showing by the state that in-person voter fraud is rampant, that it's all over the place. She wrote in her decision that lack of any sort of evidence, quote, belies any urgency for an independently fashioned remedy from the court at this time. In other words, she was saying, why don't you come back in your next legislative session and work on it then?
So she basically said the state's arguments about that are fake news?
She said that there's not enough evidence for it to be an emergency.
There you go.
She certainly said that. Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick says he is not at war with Speaker Joe Strauss. You buy that?
They're not at war. Yeah.
He hesitated on it. However, that is not keeping Patrick from saying things like this.
The special session ended because Joe Strauss, the Speaker of the House, is a quitter.
He's a quitter, he says. Dan Patrick was on the Mark Davis Show on 660 AM, The Answer, up in Dallas-Fort Worth. And for Dan Patrick, you know, you've got all these issues out there that he's passionate about, bathrooms, school vouchers, et cetera. But for him, property taxes are basically the Alamo.
I'm not going to pass a phony baloney bill that does nothing. I'm not going to be one of those politicians that comes home and says, we passed Senate Bill 1 with the House on property tax reform, because there was no reform. And they quit on the people of Texas. They quit on the taxpayers. I said at the time, had Strauss been at the Alamo, he'd have looked at his watch and said to Colonel Travis, sorry, I've got to go right now before the big battle starts.
Oh, the Alamo references are being thrown down.
They sure are. And again, you know, you have Patrick saying that Strauss would have looked at his watch and said, hey, I've got to get out of here. Again, he leaves out that I think in the – okay, it's either one of two things. Either Patrick is Santa Ana – I'm going to come back to this. We mentioned it on the show last week. Either Patrick is Santa Ana or the cities and counties of the state are Santa Ana. One of them has to be in that analogy, right?
Maybe. I actually talked to the lieutenant governor, and asked him if Strauss climbed over the wall, then – who was Patrick in the Alamo?
Yeah, what did he say?
Didn't get a clear answer on that.
Okay. Well, he does know what he thinks about Strauss, though. He says that Strauss is basically a closet Democrat.
Joe Strauss, remember, was elected by 64 Democrats and 12 Republicans back in 2009, I guess it was, a coup d'etat of the Republican Party. And he answers to the Democrats, and we all know they don't want smaller government and less taxes. So he made a deal with some Republicans. Look, he stays as Speaker with 55 Democrats. There are 55 Democrats now, 55 Democrats and 21 Republicans at 76 votes as a simple majority. That's who he answers to. Greg Abbott and I answer to the people of Texas, particularly the Republicans who elected us. And Greg Abbott has said time and time again since the end of session last week, the failure of these key issues were on Joe Strauss and Joe Strauss's personal politics to stay in power.
The thing that he doesn't say there is that the Speaker of the House is elected by Republicans who are conservatives and Democrats who are liberals, and some Democrats and Republicans are probably more moderate. So the entire spectrum, right?
Right.
What he also said there was that he, Dan Patrick, and Abbott are primarily elected by conservative Republicans. So basically saying that, look, in Texas, and this is the reality and has been for a while, the Republican primary, when you're talking statewide, it is the election of consequence, right?
Right.
If you win that, then, you know, at least according to the last election results we had in 2014 statewide, as long as you win the Republican primary in March, then just all you have to do is avoid being the Democrat in November. All you have to do before November is not switch parties, right?
Right.
And you'll be elected by 21 points in 2014. So you could make the argument that Abbott and Patrick are representative of conservative Republicans who vote in the primaries, and Strauss, on the other hand, is having to represent all of Texas because his constituency is Democrats and Republicans, liberals, moderates, and conservatives.
You could make that argument.
All right. We'll see if anybody does. All right. Dan Patrick also said to Mark Davis that, look, he doesn't get involved in speaker politics. Despite all the comments that we just heard, he doesn't actually weigh in on who the Speaker of the House ought to be. He was asked specifically about that. Should there be a new speaker? And he backed up on the question, sort of.
Well, I don't get in that involved in that politics. I'm just telling you the way it is. Very frustrating for me that Strauss and Abbott, we run statewide. We're responsible to the people, and we're linked together on these issues, and the speaker is not. Here's what people need to ask their local representatives that serve in the House. They need to ask them, did you vote for the Senate bill to lower property taxes at 4%, or did you vote with the speaker that would have only lowered it to 6% increases, which would have given no one tax relief? Because of our 95 Republicans, Mark, 44 in the House voted with the speaker on not giving tax relief. They need to ask the question, did you vote for the 4% plan or the 6% plan? Because the difference meant $200 million in tax relief, our plan, and zero in tax relief on their plan. You need to ask them, did you sign up on the privacy bill to stop boys and girls from showering in schools, or did you stick with the speaker? And then I guess you do need to ask the question, are you going to vote for the speaker next session, who is undermining the political party in our conservative state? Look, he's a big spending liberal Republican. He admits it.
What Dan Patrick does not admit there, that is, it's that he is getting involved in speaker politics, right?
Right.
He says, I don't get involved in that. But then he says, you should ask your representative whether or not they're going to vote for Speaker Strauss, or who are they going to vote for speaker?
This big spending liberal Republican.
Yes. Now, when he talks about property taxes there, he said that their version in the Senate, SB1, as rolled out by Senator Paul Betancourt from Houston, would save Texans how much? $200 million?
Right.
Where's that number coming from?
I have no idea.
Okay.
That's a new number.
What the bill would do, as laid out in the Senate, and there are some details on this you can get down into the weeds, but the main thing is it would have capped property tax growth at 4% for cities and counties. And if it grew more than that, the city and county leadership would have to come to you, come to the voters, and it would be mandatory. They'd have to have an election. Right, they'd have to convince you that it's a good idea to raise taxes more than that.
And my guess is that based on the extrapolated numbers of the current rate of increases and other things, that's where they come up with the $200 million.
He's coming up with $200 million as it was laid out by Betancourt. Though, this is a bill that would save you maybe between $3 and $9 a month. Right, when you start taking numbers like $200 million and spreading it out over all the homeowners in 254 counties in the state, you get a tiny little piece, and it's not that you would actually save $3. It's that your taxes wouldn't go up $3 more than they otherwise would have. Does that make sense? They're saying that they want to cap the rate of growth. But nowhere in any of this debate was anybody saying in a serious way that they were going to cut your property taxes, which I think is what conservative Republican voters and others would like to hear as well, because as we've said many times on the show, property taxes is a real issue. Those taxes really are eating people alive all across the state. But there is no serious bill that they've talked about in Austin so far that would actually make your bill go down.
That's right. And based on the volume of emails and text messages that we received last week, this is a big issue for people across Texas.
Yeah.
To a large degree in the urban areas where the tax rates are going up at a higher rate. Mm-hmm. You're right. No one has talked about cutting property taxes. It is a start to slow the growth of skyrocketing property taxes. which people seem to think, okay, that's a start, but when are you going to start cutting them?
Right. That's what people would like to hear. You had Strauss say over and over again during the special session anyway. He didn't really get into this as much during the regular session, but prior to the special session, he gave that speech in San Antonio where he said a couple of things. One was that the 20 for 20 list that was put out by Abbott, prior to the special, that was a pile of horse manure.
Right.
That's the analogy he gave. He told a very funny joke. And that Ronald Reagan used to always tell, so
right.
It's fine. But he also said that if you want to have real property tax reform and if you really want to cut anybody's property taxes, then you have to have a real conversation about school finance reform and completely remaking the way that schools are paid for in the state. Because when you look at that bill, it is half is the ISD in your area.
That's right.
So if the state was kicking in more money there, then you might see your property tax bills go down. But you always hear people say this, Mike, that the state needs to kick in more. Either way, it's taxpayers kicking in more, right? It's just a different form of taxation. The state only has certain revenue streams available. What are those? I mean, sales taxes, oil and gas tax receipts, a few other things, but there's no income tax. There's no casino gambling. There's a lot of things that are just totally off the table. So to completely do a redo would be a heavy lift. It would be very difficult, much more difficult than simply saying to smaller governments, you have to do more with less.
Restructuring Texas's tax system. Mm-hmm. There's probably almost no one in the legislature who seriously wants to get in that, because at some point when you talk about people kicking in more,
yeah,
you're talking about tax hikes on some people.
On something.
Well, the Republicans are not the tax hike folks.
No.
They're the tax cutting folks.
Yeah.
And a lot of the people who are out in Texas, number of whom who emailed us last week, said, okay, so fine, slow the rate of growth. Mm-hmm. When are they going to start cutting property taxes?
Yes. So you're saying it wouldn't be that easy to get into all that in a 30-day special session?
Won't happen in a 30-day special session. Obviously didn't in this one. It's a tough stretch. If you look historically in Texas, it's a tough stretch to even do that in a regular session. It generally takes more than one session to get tax restructuring through, because every time you change the tax structure, someone, some business, somebody else who has planned on the tax structure being the way it is, mm-hmm. They don't want anything changed.
Right.
So it's a long, painful discussion.
Patrick on the warpath about that, and one prediction you can make is that he will be on the warpath about that all through the Republican primaries, for sure.
You betcha.
And likely all the way through the next election, prior to the next regular session of the legislature in 2019. Another man on a warpath is Lyle Larson from San Antonio. This is a Republican who has been, talking about what he says is the most corrupt thing in Texas government. The ability of the governor to, and he calls it pay for play,
mm-hmm.
The ability of the governor to appoint people to various boards and commissions that do have a lot of power over people's lives. They kind of run state government when the legislature's not in town, which, knock on wood, is only every 2 years for 5 months.
Exactly.
But a lot of times those appointments go to big contributors to the governor's political campaign. That's not new, right?
Right.
That happened with Rick Perry, happened with George Bush, happened with Ann Richards, et cetera.
It's happened for eons.
Yes. Whether you think it's good or bad, that's a different question. The fact is it has been the way we do business here in Texas for a long time. Well, Lyle Larson says that the governor is now being vindictive to him personally. The governor sent Larson a letter yesterday that we posted at quorumreport.com. The letter simply said that your services are no longer needed on the commission on which Larson has served for a while. It's the Southwestern States Water Commission, which Larson actually helped to set up in the first place. He was very upset about this. Larson, by the way, is the chairman of the Texas House Natural Resources Committee. And after he was notified by the governor that his services are no longer needed on this commission, Larson said this in a written statement, again, that we published at quorumreport.com. Quote, "It appears that the governor's vengeance continues in response to filing legislation that would end the silent auction of boards and commissions by the governor's office." Larson talked about this during the special session. He had said that not only was he targeted on his appointment to this commission, but also a bunch of his bills were vetoed because he had filed that bill going after the governor.
I think that looking at that bill, I realized that The governor didn't like the bill. He vetoed more of my bills than anybody else's in the House. Also, the lieutenant governor didn't like it because he held six of my bills and never referred them to committee. And he told me directly it was because they didn't like that bill. I think it's imperative that if we control both the legislative and executive branch of government, that we should reform the most egregious ethics violation we've got in this state. And that's where people have to pay large sums of money to get appointed to covenant seats, as highly coveted seats, as like Board of Regents, Parks and Wildlife Boards. And I've had folks in my district that have pursued those, and it was told to them that they would have to participate in the campaign side of it before they were selected for positions. The Board of Regents at A&M, you're going to have to spend between $200,000 and $300,000, and Board of Regents at UT, between $300,000 and $400,000 on an average. Being an Aggie, I don't understand that.
Now, his bill, his prescription for this would be this. It would have prevented any governor, not just Abbott, but governors from appointing anybody who had given the governor more than $2,500 in the previous year, which is, you know, in Texas politics, that's a laughably small number, right?
Right.
You know, the guys who give money to, let me put it this way, people who end up on boards of regents, for example, generally give a lot more money than that to the governor of the state. And again, that was true for all governors. It would also restrict appointees to giving no more than $2,500 a year while they are on those boards. So they couldn't give more than $2,500 before they were appointed. It'd be the same for each year that they would be on the boards. I don't know that that's ever going to fly in this state.
I don't know. I don't think there's any particular push to get this legislation passed, mm-hmm. although Governor Abbott campaigned on a strong ethics reform platform.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
He made ethics one of his major priorities for the legislative session. And there's been no movement on this so far, but, you know, who knows?
Doesn't seem to be one of those things that people ever get all that fired up about.
Anytime you ask politicians to restrict themselves with campaign contributions mm-hmm. or imposing additional ethics guidelines on themselves, they generally don't want to do that.
Yeah, and Chairman Larson, he may have a point here. You know, I was talking to a lot of people in the Capitol community about his comments in which he said, you know, the other stuff that he said in that statement yesterday, things along the lines of, you know, vindictiveness is the major character flaw of Greg Abbott. I talked with some people who said, well, that might be right, but if you're trying to be an effective lawmaker and you want to have your bills actually signed into law, that's not the way you talk about the governor. So maybe there is some balance to be found.
Perhaps. You know, at some level, there's a lot of people in Austin unhappy with each other.
Sure.
Much as there is in Washington.
Absolutely.
Think about it.
Well, yes. At Texas A&M, they are standing by the decision to cancel that White Lives Matter rally.
Right.
That, you know, drew so much criticism. It was condemned by every member of the Texas House. You have this former student from Texas A&M who linked his planned rally to the Charlottesville riot, which is probably a genius thing to do if you actually want to hold an event. Look, he had said that he just wants to bring a message and not bring violence. But the chancellor, John Sharp, had canceled the rally, and there were those who said that Texas A&M is stomping on the First Amendment rights of this group. Charles Schwartz, who's chairman of the Board of Regents of Texas A&M system, said, quote, "Violence has no place in a university setting. I support our administration and condemn those who would claim a right under the First Amendment to incite violence and those who would put the safety of our community at risk." The gentleman who was lining this up, the former student at A&M, said, quote, "We're there to bring a message. I guess it's lawsuit time. Time to go hash this out in the courts."
Another lawsuit.
Well, on First Amendment arguments, there are, as I understand it, there are exemptions for public safety. Even if you're talking about, you know,
right.
a public university, which is supposed to be an open forum for all ideas, and you know, you do hear a lot of arguments about, and you rightly hear arguments about the idea that if you're talking First Amendment, if you're talking free speech, you can't restrict it only to ideas that you agree with. There's going to be
right.
all sorts of things that are objectionable There's probably people who listen to this program who think this about us every week. There are probably things that people hear that they don't like and that they would not like to hear on the public airwaves or hear in a podcast or see in the Houston Chronicle or see in quorumreport.com. But they don't get to restrict that. The difference here is that these officials are bringing up the potential of violence. And when you have that potential, which I don't think that there'd be a difficult case to be made, you know, particularly after what just happened in Charlottesville, it wouldn't be difficult to say we do fear that students are going to be put in harm's way if you have an event like this on the Texas A&M campus in College Station.
Speech that incites violence,
mm-hmm.
questionable, problematic.
Mm-hmm.
Hate speech, whether that's free speech, mm-hmm. that's part of the national dialogue that's going on right now.
Right.
There's a lot of issues that are coming out as a part of this discussion that are interesting issues.
Sure.
And are causing people to think a lot about free speech and about how the business of government and at some level the business of society is being conducted.
Mm-hmm. A lot of these folks who want to relive the Civil War, we talked about it in our last program. If people want to go back and listen to last week's episode if they hadn't heard it, we went in depth on the fact that all these different Confederate monuments all over the place, there are different meanings behind a bunch of them. There were different eras in which some of those were put up. Some were erected right after the Civil War. Some were put up like right in the midst of Jim Crow. Some of them were put up after the Brown versus Board of Education decision that
right.
integrated the schools. And so, you know, the context in which these things were, you know, put in place is part of the discussion. And there are heated arguments on both sides. For example, you have a plaque at the Capitol that says that the Civil War was not anything about slavery, and instead it was only about states' rights. Well, I think at a minimum you could argue that it was about both. People have, in fact, you had a Republican former education commissioner, Michael Williams, put in an op-ed. He said that, look, it's not history if it's not true. And if you look at the Civil War, every state that left cited slavery and the rights of the people in those states to hold slaves, to be able to buy and sell slaves. That was part of why they were leaving. So to say that it had nothing to do with slavery and the fact that that particular plaque was put up after Brown versus Board of Education, that adds a complete different context to it. I've heard some very conservative people say, take that one down. But on other monuments, could be up for debate.
The monuments at the state capitol and other representations, mm-hmm. Historical representations at the capitol are now under review. There's quite a number of monuments at the capitol that reference the Confederate states, the Confederacy. I'm going to argue that the discussion that is going on now, the public debate that's going on now, is an educational process that is probably needed to resolve at some level a number of these issues, racial issues and historical issues that have been out there for a number of years.
Yeah, and we're going to have more of it here in Texas than they are in
exactly.
a lot of other places, particularly because of the fact, specifically because we have almost more of those Confederate monuments than any other state. The only one that has more is Virginia.
We're larger than these other states, mm-hmm. and Texas was obviously part of the Confederacy, but I think as the discussion and the debate continues here, the violence issue aside,
yeah.
I think that people need to listen because there's an educational process here that's going on about history.
Yeah, people were very upset with the way President Trump handled the discussion after Charlottesville and the fact that he has also defended some of these monuments in a way that was less than eloquent, let's say it that way. He was roundly criticized by some people in his own party and certainly by Democrats as well. One of the people who's been highly critical of the president all along during the campaign and now is the owner of the Dallas Mavericks, Mark Cuban.
Right.
There was a poll out this week that said that if Cuban were to run against Trump for the presidency in the next election, that he'd beat him. 42-38 was the number. Now, Cuban has been, as I mentioned, critical, but not always. In the opening days of his presidency, he was on CNN, and he described Trump in a very interesting way.
I call it political chemotherapy, right? And one of my friends, who I always thought was really smart, I'm not saying he's dumb, but had a different viewpoint on why he voted for Trump. I didn't expect him to vote for him. He said, Mark, I voted for politicians my entire life. He's in his 50s, right? You know what the definition of insanity is? Doing the same thing over and over, expecting different results. And so I voted for Donald Trump. Is he poisonous in a lot of respects? Yeah, this is our chemotherapy. You know, we hope he's going to change the political system. And if that's the way you're evaluating Donald Trump, he's doing a phenomenal job.
So a lot of people may have heard that and thought, yeah, so you have Trump in there who is killing some of the bad cells. That's what chemotherapy does, right? Kills the cancerous cells. But then I think there are a lot of people, even some who had originally supported Trump, who have started to view it like, well, he's also killing some of the good cells in there. Now he's also killing healthy cells. What is going on? You know, his approval rating continues to – well, it's hovered, you know, right, between 36 and 40, something like that. It goes down and down. Then it may come up a little bit. But with Republican voters, he's been on pretty solid ground, although last week we did see a poll that showed he had dropped about 12 points, even with the people who are his most ardent supporters, Republican primary voters. And we have also seen various polls show that the longer he's in office, the fewer people are self-identifying as Republican, right? So the actual number, the base there, is getting smaller, at least according to the numbers. Now, this man doesn't listen. That's what Mark Cuban says is one of his main problems.
You know, when it comes to communication skills, you know, have you seen him answer any questions? What's the one topic you look at him and say, boy, he has in-depth knowledge? And at some point you have to, and I said this to him directly, at some point you have to communicate an understanding of the issues. That's where communication skills are critical. Now we're seeing, you know, again, I use the word cocooning, they're cocooning him so he doesn't have to address and actually answer any questions. And when you look at or and read about the meetings he has with business leaders or other organizations, it's always the same thing. Tell me what you think, right? It's never, let's have an in-depth conversation. Let's get to the core of a matter. You don't ever hear him saying, let's discuss the three R's of Obamacare, right? Let's discuss the issues of the new Paul Ryan proposal. And here's what I disagree or what I agree with. It's always top line. It's always superficial. And if you can't delve into the issues, how are you going to come to a resolution on anything?
Trump had said when they were trying to pass the repeal of Obamacare, and this was based on some of the reporting that he had said, I don't care about the details. In fact, he used some very colorful language to say that. I won't say it here. But he said, I don't care about those details. Just put a bill on my desk. Well, of course, that did not work out. What might a debate sound like between Cuban and Trump? It might be a little loud.
It might be a little bit loud, you know.
A little over the top?
A little over the top. Mm-hmm. I'd be shocked if it wasn't. You know, part of Cuban's arguments about Trump is not getting off into the weeds discussing these problems in detail is totally counter to that political chemotherapy argument, it might seem, because if he's saying that we elected somebody who is not part of the system to go in and be a disruptor in the system, to change the system, then that person is obviously not going to have all the details to be able to get off in some kind of in-depth policy discussion. Well, so I don't know. Let's get the two of them up there to debate. Maybe they can have an in-depth discussion.
Here's what Cuban sounds like when he's mixing it up with some folks about what leadership is all about. Here he was on ABC's The View talking about what it takes not only to be president, but also what it takes to do Cuban's job now, which is to be the owner of the Dallas Mavericks.
You're never going to know everything to be the president, so you have to be smart enough to say, here's where my strengths are, here's what I don't know. Let me go out and find the best people to do that.
Yep.
Right? And then listen to those people.
Yeah.
Look, you can make an argument that Donald Trump has hired some good people around him. Maybe some you don't like, but he's put some good people around.
Okay.
But he never listens, right? And if you're not willing to listen, if you're not willing to learn, because the entire job, the only certainty of the job of president is the uncertainty. You don't know what's next.
Would you hire someone with no experience in basketball to run your organization?
Everybody's always a rookie when they first step on the court for the first time. When you walk down and you prosecuted a case, you know, or in trial, you have to do it for the first time. And
right.
The question is, what are your skills when you walk in, and how willing are you to learn? And that's what's missing
right
now.
But you haven't answered that.
That's what's missing right now, he says, that he's not willing to learn. So you could imagine that if the ladies on The View had asked him the question, why should you be president instead of Donald Trump? This is what he might have said.
He's oblivious to life. You cannot be, he has no self-awareness. He has no contextual awareness. He is oblivious to everything. He's not very smart.
But other than that, he said he's doing a great job as president. Cuban trying to have it both ways on all this. And I'll tell you, he did make a brief comment about the possibility that he'd run for president. This was how he was quoted in the Dallas Morning News. Quote, I would only run if I had solutions to problems like health care, jobs, and income inequality. He also said, once I get there, I'll let you know. And he put a smiley face in the email.
There you go. You know, I'm going to argue here that this is part of another discussion that's going on, public debate and discussion. People wake up in the morning, they hear stuff that President Trump has done or said overnight, and they're going, what are we doing here? You know, I like this, or is this guy crazy, or what? And that's also part of a public debate that's going on over our political system and how it should work, how it's working, how it's not working. Everybody's going to have their own view on that. And so I think this debate is going to continue as well over the next probably 4 years.
Well, it comes down to this is an analogy I've used a few times. As journalists, it's sort of our job to be like the EKG for democracy and government. Every day we check in, we're always, you know, keeping track of the pulse, right, of what's happening, what's going on in campaigns and in government. The voters are like the doctor. And you know, when you're at the hospital, the doctor just comes by every once in a while, right? They come by. In fact, in this case, they come by like every 4 years.
Right.
And they say, okay, well, maybe we need a little more Republican or a little more Democrat.
Right.
Right. Now, in the years in between, it might have killed the patient. And we would know it, that it was going on, because we're here tracking it every day. But in this case, you know, you had Cuban talking about chemotherapy. Some people might say at this point it might be time to discontinue that treatment. Maybe try something else. That's what I think. That's what people are. A lot of people are settling on that. The people who you know, have answered those polls and giving him, you know, they're giving Trump an approval rating right around, you know, 36% to 40%.
So we'll be looking for the DC on the chart.
Yes. What do you think about a Mark Cuban presidential run? Let us know what you think. If you think that it's a terrible idea, tweet at Mike Ward. At Chronicle Mike. If you think it's a good idea, tweet at Mike Ward, at Chronicle Mike. Tweet anything else you like at me, at Scott Braddock. I'm Scott Braddock, editor at QuorumReport.com. For real-time updates and insights from the Texas Capitol, just go there to QuorumReport.com.
And I'm Mike Ward, Austin Bureau Chief for the Houston Chronicle and HoustonChronicle.com, and the one who will be answering all these direct messages via Twitter.
Yes. I think that I'm only going to ask you this question. I'm going to ask it of you this time. Mike, are you having fun yet?
I'm having fun.